Hosanna, a Fellowship of Christians.
Well, let me tell you a story with a little more serious tone to it. Introduce you to a guy named Ricky Jackson. Ricky was 19 years old when he and his two best friends were arrested for killing Harold Franks outside of a convenience store. Eddie Vernon, a local paperboy who knew these guys, told police that they were the ones who did it, that Ricky Jackson fired the handgun. Now, later on, Eddie failed to identify Ricky in a police lineup. Several of his classmates testified that Eddie was nowhere near the scene. No weapon was found. And Ricky testified he had never even met, he never even seen Harold Franks. Nevertheless, one jury, and actually in the end, three separate juries, convicted Ricky of murder due to Eddie Vernon's testimony, and he was sentenced to die by electric chair. The law was changed, and executions were no longer permitted, and he stayed in prison 39 years until 2015, when he was released from prison and fully exonerated after Eddie Vernon recanted his testimony. Mm-hmm. Eddie said he had been coerced by the police to finger Ricky and his friends for the murder. Eddie was only 12 years old at the time. So Ricky Jackson has the sad distinction of having served longer in prison than any American who was later found innocent of the crime that put him there. He was terribly, terribly wronged by Eddie Vernon and by the whole criminal justice system. Now think about that for a moment. How would you feel if you were imprisoned, labeled, shamed for a crime you didn't commit? Ricky said, "The boy I was before prison with all his dreams, all his intentions, he died the moment I was locked up. But even in his darkest moments in nearly 40 years, he said, I had this ember inside of me, some little smoldering piece of hope. I'd say, if I give up, what am I really surrendering to?" So he spent a lot of time in the prison library for reasons he could not fully understand. Why study flowers if you're never going to see them? And he wrote letters trying to get someone on the outside to pay attention to his case. A reporter heard about him, wrote about him, and Eddie Vernon's pastor read the article and got involved. Ricky Jackson calls his new life a rebirth. Eddie Vernon met with him after his release and apologized. And Ricky forgave him. He was just this goofy little kid who told a whopper. Besides, he said, it wasn't only Eddie that put us there. It was the lawyers, the police, the whole broken system. And there are a lot of innocent men out there who are never going to get justice. In that sense, I feel lucky. His attitude is amazing, isn't it? I feel lucky. I forgive you. I feel reborn. How is that possible after so great a wrong? How do we respond when we are wronged? Mm-hmm. In ways that probably are far less than what he experienced. How do we respond when we wrong others? Mm-hmm. Or see others being wronged? And why should the world be surprised if those who are in Christ honor those who wrong us? Mm-hmm. Why should they expect anything different from us at all, given that we know Christ? Last week we said that Jesus honors everyone, including those who are wrong. Thanks for not insisting that we were wrong about that. Nobody threw vegetables at us or anything. It is true.
Yeah.
It is good, even if it's not the way we've sometimes been taught to understand God. This week, we're going to take that coin, flip it over, and see that Jesus also honors those who are wronged.
Yes.
ED at the end. We're going to do the same pattern we did last week. We're going to look at three groups of wronged people that Jesus honored when he was here on earth. Beginning with those like Ricky Jackson who are wronged by unjust systems. What do I mean by that? The way things are often done in this broken world. Mm-hmm. The way things are done are usually not the fault of any one particular person. It's often just an unconscious assumptions about the way things are. And what happens is that very often because it's broken, people get hurt. People are wronged as a result of those systems. So to do that, let's start with the story of Jesus meeting another man. So this is from Luke chapter 5. One day, while Jesus was ministering in a certain city, he came upon a man covered with leprous sores. I'm going to interrupt for a moment here and say, what we would recognize today is a bunch of different skin diseases. They just kind of stuck them all together in the ancient world, and they classified them as leprosy. And they were scared to death of leprosy. My goodness, there are so many prohibitions and fears and things in the ancient world about leprosy. The worst of these diseases that were called leprosy was pretty nasty. It would eat away a person's flesh. It would leave them disabled, stinky, and it was wrongly believed it would leave them contagious. To be a leper was not merely to have a horrible medical condition, though. It was also to be immediately unwelcome in your world. Because they thought it was contagious, they pushed these people away, and those folks became untouchable, quarantined, like maybe a victim of coronaviruses in this week's news. Shut away from their home, their family, their friends, the synagogue, the marketplace, as long as they remained sick, and for many of them, that was for life. But it got even worse than that, if you can imagine it. Now, everything I've said up to now might evoke pity, all those poor people. But the ancient world had almost zero pity for lepers. I mean, how is that possible? It was also because they thought that those folks also deserved it. Something bad happens to you, God must be punishing you. That was their theology. That's the way they've been taught. And many people still believe this. Even when we don't believe it in our head, there are people who believe it somewhere in our heart. When something bad happens, we cry out, God, what are you doing to me? As if that's the way that God works. And so lepers were excluded, not just to prevent disease, but because people didn't want them around. Now, you would think that the religious leaders would challenge this merciless system, but no, they reinforced it. Leprosy was diagnosed by priests, not by doctors. It was seen as a spiritual disease with physical symptoms. And that's because the God that they had imagined was a God who dishonored people. And so lepers had to live without medical care. It's kind of hard to recover from a disease if you never get care. Without priestly care, stay away from the temple. That's where the holy God is, and you're not holy. Begging for food from a distance, please leave it here because I can't approach you. And if a healthy person would accidentally come close by, lepers were required by law to yell out and warn them. Anybody know what they were supposed to yell out? Unclean, unclean. And you know what another word for that is? Dirty. I'm dirty. That's what they were told they were. Dirty in body and dirty in spirit. And some of us have been told the same thing. Mm-hmm. And many people still believe it about themselves, that they're dirty and they're shameful. And that's why they are or need to be rejected by other people and by God. They're dishonorable and dishonored. And if I'm touching any nerves here this morning, I wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. These things run deep and they hit hard. But then there's Jesus, because this story continues. What happens when Jesus meets this leper? Let's pick it up again. When the man recognized Jesus, he fell on his face at Jesus' feet and begged to be healed, saying, if you were only willing, you could completely heal me. Do you see what's going on here? Instead of yelling unclean, this man, instead of running away like he was required by law to do, this man runs to Jesus. Falls down at his feet. It was probably pure desperation and a little bit of hope. I know you. You're the one that they talk about. You're the one that can do miracles. And what will Jesus do in response to this? What do you think? You know his heart. You know his character. You may know this story. Jesus reached out and touched him and said, of course I am willing to heal you. And now you will be healed. Instantly the leper sores were healed and his skin became smooth. Yay! Jesus has compassion on him and does another miracle. And that could be the end of the story, but there's more going on here. Mm-hmm. Look at the sequence of events, because this really matters. Jesus reached out and touched him. He did what no one else would dare to do. He touched a leper before healing him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a finger poke, by the way. The Greek word used here implies an embrace. Let's take a look at that picture if we could.
Yeah.
That's the way I picture it. I love that picture. No one would hug a leper. They thought they would get dirty. They would get sick. Jesus didn't see a dirty man. He saw a lonely, broken, sick man and a wronged man. And so Jesus honored his soul, which had always been loved by God and wasn't dirty any more than anybody else's is, even before healing his disease, which was, after all, just a disease. And we all get sick. Jesus honored others besides lepers who were wronged by the systems of the world. We talk about that here from time to time. He honored the women. He honored the poor. He honored the elderly. Everybody who was unjustly labeled and shamed and rejected. He still does.
Yep.
I remember my frustration couple decades ago trying to get a job in higher education at the moment when universities were looking to primarily for women and minorities. It's not fair! And I realized that getting passed over for jobs could instead create in me compassion for those who had had that sort of thing happen to them their whole lives.
Yep.
Or for generations. And Jesus honored me, I think, for my change of heart. Jesus honors those who honor others who are wronged, especially those who embrace and heal lepers. Mm-hmm. Who are the lepers in our world? Who are the lepers in your life? You know, we can't fix the whole messed up world. We can't change a whole system on our own. But we can do what Jesus said, which is to see and honor the wronged persons in front of us, especially if we've been told that they're dirty.
Yeah. So Jesus honors everyone. Those, as Tony was just showing us, he honors those who are wronged by unjust systems. And second, Jesus honors those who are both wronged and wrong. See, those who are wronged can be wrong themselves. One example of this is found in John 8, where the scribes and the Pharisees drag to Jesus a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery and throw her at his feet. Interesting, huh? The lepers are on the ground at people's feet, and here they are throwing this woman caught in adultery at Jesus' feet. And she was obviously wrong, right? She was caught in the act. But she was also wronged. She was taken physically. She was physically forced to go out in public, to stand alone, half naked, in front of a big crowd as they're all gawking at her. And the religious leaders are standing there talking about her like she isn't there, defining her sin while being blind to her as a person. See, they were just using her as an object in order to catch Jesus in some sin of his own. We read in John 8, 5, they say, "In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him, so they might have some charge to bring against him. And here they are, they're quoting Moses, they're quoting the law as their authority. But see, here's the thing, they quote it wrong. They quote it wrong, and they're wronging her in the process. How interesting that people who supposedly follow Moses' example and the letter of the law are using it to condemn this woman while violating it themselves. See, the law clearly sentences to death both the woman and the man who commit adultery. Now you got to watch this. Jesus, he could have pointed out their wrong by asking them a simple question: where's the man? But you know what? There's more going on here. Jesus sees something far greater than simply keeping the letter of the law. And he is what he does is in the way that they've exposed her, he exposes them in the act of their sin. How does he do it? He does it by squatting down and silently writing in the sand with his finger. Do you ever wonder about that? And as he's doing that, oh, the legalists, they keep firing questions at him like stones. So Jesus stands up calmly and he says, "Let anyone among you who's without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again, he bends down and he writes on the ground. Wow, you know what? You know what the legalists do with this? They're always trying to figure out what he wrote in the sand. They want to know what he wrote in the sand. Letter of the law, right? Oh, if we could only know that. But see, what matters here is not what he wrote, it's how he wrote it. He wrote it with his finger on the ground, and he wrote it twice. Remember who he's exposing. These experts in the law, these Pharisees, they would have known exactly what Jesus was doing. He was physically exposing their wrong by reenacting the truth of the scriptures, the truth of Moses, right in front of them. See, he was prophetically enacting the truth in the book of Exodus that the Ten Commandments were written on stone tablets with what? The finger of God. And when Moses brought them down from the mountain, what did he find? He found the people committing adultery with another god, with a golden calf. And what did Moses do? He literally threw the written stones at them in judgment. Are you getting this? So God, what did God do? He wrote them a second time. Only this time, God went way beyond the letter of the law. He revealed himself. He exposed himself, who he really is, to Moses. See, God didn't throw rocks. He didn't throw stone tablets. He had Moses bring two new blank tablets, right? Exodus 34, 6. And God, Moses is standing there with these tablets. God passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin." Is God holy and just? Yes, God does act justly. But God's the only one who can. See, God did not intend the law to be used like they were using it with that woman that day to try to trap him. God didn't intend the law to be used as a weapon of judgment to stone people who are wrong. The law was and always is meant to be a revelation of God's compassion, a way of actually protecting people from being wronged. Protecting people who are wrong. So Jesus bent down twice. Do you see that? Twice he wrote with his finger in the sand. So those who had wronged this woman and God could experience their hearts of stone breaking open to allow God to write his own law of love on their hearts of flesh. John 8, when they heard it, they went away. See, they got it, at least partially. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. See, the Pharisees also felt wronged, didn't they? They were wronged by this woman, just like Moses felt wronged by those calf-worshipping children of Israel. But Jesus honored them, just as God had honored Moses, because Moses, he threw those tablets at them in anger. But Jesus honored them, like God had honored Moses, by revealing who God really is and gently showing them that they were also so very wrong. Like I said, they got the first part. They dropped their stones. They didn't kill the woman. But they didn't move past those first set of tablets. Those didn't move past those judgmental stones into the law of love. See, they didn't embrace her like Jesus did the leper. But Jesus did. It says Jesus straightened up, said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. And from now on, do not sin again." This woman was both wrong and wronged. But she is left with the only one who honors her. And then Jesus goes right ahead, as if to make a point. He goes ahead and he breaks the law himself. He speaks to this sinful woman in public, and he calls her woman. He does not just treat her like an object and call her sinner. The one who refuses to hold people in their wrongs reminds her and all of us of her worth, and he invites her to walk out of a life defined by sin and wrongdoing into a life of freedom and grace. Oh yes, Jesus does indeed honor those who are both wronged and wrong.
Let's look at a third category. How Jesus honors those who are wronged, having done nothing wrong. They're innocent of what the wrong is being done against them. I've already mentioned those who are wronged by unjust systems, those who are wrong and wronged at the same time. For this third group, let's focus specifically on those who are wronged by people that they know, love, and trust. Not a system out there, not nameless ways that things are done, but real people. People with whom we're in relationship, who hurt us deeply. Jesus honors those kind of people because Jesus experienced this. Mm-hmm. He was misunderstood by his family. One of his best friends denied him. He was abandoned by nearly all of his friends when he needed them most. One of them even betrayed him. They wronged him dearly. Jesus had done nothing to deserve any of that. He had loved them, had taken care of them. He had even rescued them on occasion. So he knew what this pain was like.
Yeah.
So when he encountered others who were wrong, like that blind man we talked about last week, what's wrong with him? He's blind. You know, did he sin or did his parents sin? When he encountered folks like that, he honored them. And he told stories about people like them, including one that we told briefly last week about a father and two sons, one of the most famous stories in the New Testament. Those sons were both wrong in different ways, and they both wronged their father, although he did everything extraordinarily right. Remember that story of the prodigal father? He gave away generously, even though he knew it was a risk, even though he knew that his youngest son was probably not worthy of that kind of risk, and his fears were realized. His heart was broken by his son's abandonment of him, by the loss of all that he had worked for so many years. But Dad didn't reject that boy, did not even shame him. He waited eagerly, looking for his son's return. And when it finally happened, when his family came back, his amazing father welcomed him back with open, forgiving arms and celebrated him as if he had just done the best thing in the world. Only to hear then his older son, the stable good boy, criticize Dad for his graciousness. His good father was treated like he was a fool by both sons, regarded as wasteful with money and wasteful with love. He was no fool. And neither is God. Because Jesus makes it clear, God is that father, doling out grace so generously, with so much apparent waste, giving grace to people that don't deserve it, to those that use him, ignore him, and criticize him, to people who take advantage of God, and maybe take advantage of God's people. And yet, when they come to their senses and return to him, maybe more than once, and some of us have been that prodigal son coming back more than once in our lives, He receives them with open arms and lavishes even more of his extravagant grace upon them to celebrate their return. Yep. And they, like we said last week, are us. This is our story too. The God Jesus describes here in his picture of the prodigal father was so different from the God that others, particularly the Pharisees, had imagined. So different than the God that they used to shame people. And if somebody has used God to shame you and dishonor you, that is not the God that Jesus is describing here. Yep. Never has been, never will be. Yep. One of the best things the Christians can do for ourselves is to discover this real God, this true good God, good beyond our imagination, yeah, instead of the God that somehow we picked up along in our culture and the unjust systems of the world along the way. Yeah. The God that Jesus described would pick up a cross just for the privilege of honoring you and me. Yes. And that's why Jesus wasted his life by dying for us. Even when we were wrong, and he was wronged. Yes. If you think about it, God is always the wronged party in our relationships. Mm-hmm. But God persistently, passionately honors all of us who wrong him. Some of us have also been wronged by people we loved and trusted, just like that father. It may be life's most terrible wound. I come to think that may be the case. So very hard to recover from. But God's grace is powerful enough for even that.
Right.
And I know enough of your stories to know that there are many of you in this room who can testify to that. Mm-hmm. And his grace is powerful enough to even allow us to honor others who've had that same experience of being wronged, something that they didn't deserve. And we look at them the way that Jesus looked at them. Why would the world be surprised if those who are in Christ waste their lives honoring those who have been wrong? Yeah. Why should the world be surprised at that? Isn't that precisely what God's good people would do?
Yeah. Wow. It's a lot. Okay, everybody breathe. I know. All right, what consistent principles? Because we could stay here for days just looking at examples in Jesus' life, in his ministry. But let's begin to pull some things together for us. What are some consistent principles that we see in these examples about how Jesus honors those who are wronged? Interestingly, they're the same principles as last week. We turn the lens just a bit, and we can see some more than we saw last week. So first principle, Jesus honoring is for everyone, because God always honors everyone, always, regardless of what we do, regardless of what we don't do, and regardless of what's done to us. God always honors, whether we're innocent, whether we're the guilty party. God always honors. This is the astonishing, subversive nature of God's honoring. And this is, like Tony was just saying, such very good news for us. Because we are all imperfect human beings who are sometimes truly and deeply wronged. Yet, we all have the same just God, who will love us and who will protect us when we're wronged. And we have the same God who will one day set it all right. But we can't, you know, we're living in between the now and the not yet. The fullness of what God's justness will look like is still a bit in the future. We don't know yet how that is all going to come together. But what we can't forget here in the process as we're living into that day is that we're not only the wronged ones, we can't forget we also wrong others. Often we're doing it without even realizing we're doing it. And even there, we still have a God who will love us and not condemn us, but who will invite us to go and do as he does, go and do likewise. This is such a challenge for us, but it's also such a gift, isn't it? Because this challenge of learning to honor everyone as Jesus does, it is hard, especially when we're wronged. But Jesus sets us free. So we can not even be standing. We recognize we're standing on both sides simultaneously. So he sets us free to move from either side or from jumping back and forth, to stand in the center with him. Like he always found himself in the center of that woman and the crowd, in the center of the lepers and the communities that rejected them. Always, we can stand in the center with Jesus and see ourselves and everyone else from God's bigger perspective. And then we get to experience God's mercy, right? For ourselves and for everyone else.
And so it is true that Jesus' honoring is also compassionate. Joanne just mentioned the mercy. Mm-hmm. Last week I said that the apparent anger that Jesus directed toward the Pharisees was really a lament. It was a deep sorrow, a grieving. Well, when people have been wrong, Jesus laments again. That's his same reaction. It's compassion. And his compassion for them, and they are us, can help us dial back our own anger. Help us pause and reflect when we feel wronged. Yep. To consider, for instance, whether the wrong done may have even been intentional.
Yep.
Or may not have been about me at all. Sometimes people are just acting out and innocent bystanders get hit along the way in the middle of their own pain.
Right.
Compassion allows us to give the benefit of the doubt.
Yes.
Don't we want that? Yep. When somebody's mad at us, don't we want the benefit of the doubt? Compassion allows us to do the same before we judge harshly, before we lash out at someone who may actually be innocent. And here's the irony of it. We lash out about somebody that's harmed us and we got it wrong. We may be the ones wronging them.
Yes.
Rather than they be the ones that have wronged us. Astonishing. Anyone ever do that?
Mm-hmm.
I have.
Me too.
Take out your righteous anger, so-called righteous anger, on someone who didn't deserve it? Yikes. Contrary to what we see in the old Westerns, the world is not divided into white hats and black hats.
Yes.
Good people and bad people, wrong people and wronged people. People who like vegetables and those who don't. We need a little humor right now. This is a bit heavy, hasn't it? Every single one of us wears both hats at different points, sometimes at the same time. So rather than rushing to judgment, an awareness of how we are often in the wrong might develop us, instead of judgment, might develop a curiosity. Why did they do what they did? We told you before a little wisdom we picked up from one of our colleagues at the seminary. And you see something doing something that you don't understand, instead of saying, what's wrong with them? Ask, what happened to them?
Yes, what happened to you?
A little curiosity. Maybe it's just curiosity that can't fully be satisfied. Maybe you can't have that conversation, but to at least stop a little bit and wonder why they did what they did, particularly if we know them and we know that this is not typical of them.
Yep.
What's going on in them? And maybe it has nothing to do with me. Or if it's someone we don't know, we might still be curious. Yeah. After all, it could be a complete mistake that can be corrected very easily. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a real intentional wrong for which there is another remedy.
Mm-hmm.
Initial compassion can go a long way. At some point, of course, an intentional wrong does need to be addressed. And Jesus is very clear about this one.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Joanne.
Okay. I'm waiting for him to toss it back over here. I guess he just did. Okay. Yes, Jesus is very clear about the remedy. We don't have time this morning, I'm going to say right now, to talk about all the ins and outs, because we're given very detailed instruction about conflict resolution, about what all of this looks like. And we're going to probably just do a separate message or work it in in another. We don't have time this morning because I do want to focus on one particular aspect of that remedy. And that is Jesus honoring is truth-telling. Remember that from last week? We said last week that honoring everyone involves learning how to tell the truth in honoring ways. And that's challenging, both when we are wrong and when we are wronged. But when we're wronged, there is an especially challenging way that God invites us to tell the truth. And it's called forgiveness. Now stay with me. Because the minute you say that word in a context like this, where we're talking about how we've been wronged, immediately resistance comes up. How do you expect me to forgive that person? You have no clue what they did to me. You're right. I don't. But Jesus does. God does, and God's the one that commands us to forgive. So listen, just stay with me for a moment. This isn't about sweeping anything under the carpet. Forgiveness is not just a one-time event like our parents tried to tell us when we were kids and we'd be fighting and, you know, you hit your brother with something or whatever the wrong is. And it's not a one-time event in which we just swallow the wrong and go kiss and make up. That is not authentic forgiveness. In fact, you know, the more painfully we're wronged, the longer forgiveness can take. Forgiveness is not a one-time event. Forgiveness is an ongoing process. It is an ongoing journey of faith. But it's a process that we as Christians are commanded to participate in, because forgiveness is not simply something we give to somebody else. Forgiveness is something we need just as much. And as I said, we're going to talk about the details and in and outs of all of this another time. But what matters most this morning is the hard truth that honoring everyone includes choosing to forgive those who wrong us. And why we do that? Several reasons. First, because Jesus commands it. Jesus does it. And because he does it, he's asking it of us as well, of his followers. Also, we do this because, listen, refusing to forgive also has consequences. Forgiving, yeah, it can feel like there's some real, it's hard. There's kind of a cost to pay in a way. But unforgiveness has consequences too, like bitterness and hatred that in time will harden our hearts into stones like it did for the legalists in Jesus' day. Stones that we can throw at people who wrong us. And you know what? You might say, that's fine. I'm going to harden my heart because it hurts too much and I'm just going to do to them what they did to me. You know what? That stony heart, it doesn't just close you off from the one who wronged you. A stony heart closes us off from everything. And that stony heart will also stifle the life of Christ in you. And it will hinder your ability to live the full, free, abundant life that Jesus gives us when we're willing to walk around like he did, with our hearts open, hearts of flesh. God took on flesh. With our hearts open, listen, even when they're broken. Yeah, the resistance, it's there. We let it be there because this is not easy stuff. You've been there. You may be there right now with like this pushback. I've been there. It helps us to recognize what forgiveness is not and what it is. First, what it's not. Forgiveness is not forgetting. You may, depending on the way you've been wronged, you may have that memory, even in flashbacks, if it was traumatizing. You may have that memory. It may always be there, but listen, in time, God can heal. He doesn't erase it. We have brains that memories get registered in. But what he can do is he begins to take the pain out of the memory. How do you know when you've forgiven? When you can remember without hurt, without pain. It's not forgetting. It's not condoning either. It's not saying that what was done to you is okay and that it didn't matter. You're not condoning anything. Wrong is wrong. And when you're wronged, you're not condoning it by forgiving. Forgiveness, it's also not pardon. It's not saying that the person who wronged you can just walk away scot-free. It feels like that, doesn't it, sometimes? No. The person who wronged you is still responsible because God's just, still responsible for what they've done. And you know, if amends are called for in some way, you have the right to seek them. Forgiveness doesn't mean, oh, I let this person who abused me or my child or whoever off the hook, they go scot-free and you don't go to court. That's not what it's talking about in the New Testament when it says don't take a brother or sister to court. It's not what it's talking about. If there's amends called for, you have the right to seek them, but not with a stony, cold heart that just wants them to suffer. Do you see the difference? And forgiveness is also not reconciliation. Oh my gosh, Tony, we have to do a whole bunch of messages on
this. We do, yeah.
Because how do you honor? You can honor someone. Let's say someone rapes you, or your wife, or your daughter, someone you love. In some Christian teachings, we're taught when you forgive them, it means you should be able to sit down and have dinner with them. Or you should be able to continue on the, you know, a relationship that's close. No, it doesn't mean that. Forgiveness is one way. That's why we're commanded by God to do it. We can follow this command because it's just us and God. Primarily. That's where it starts. Me and God. I tell God the truth about what it felt like and what was done to me. I talk to him about how unjust this is. I tell him the truth. And then he tells me the truth. If you don't forgive, you're going to become less than the one that I created you to be. You are not going to be free. We do that. So we receive, you see, it's one way between me and God. That's forgiveness. Reconciliation is not a command in the scriptures. Reconciliation is between two parties. So it's like forgiveness, if there's a bridge, like there's a rift or there's a wrong that's you know, created this damage. What I can do is build half the bridge with God. I can walk up and I can stand in the middle of the part of the bridge that I can do, but I can't build a bridge for the other part. The other person or the other people must wake up and do their work, and they've got to recognize what they've done and how they've wronged me. And then when they do their one way, they can walk up and meet me, and then we work it out. Does it make sense? That's reconciliation. They're not the same. It's not. Forgiveness is a command, and it's for us, for our good. Reconciliation is a hope that, thank God, one day we're going to be living fully into that. So, but and forgiveness, sorry. We're kind of okay on time. Forgiveness, though, as I said, it is a command. Why? Because it's grace for us. Ultimately, it releases the person who was wronged from the heavy weight of vengeance and replaces it with the glorious, or the heavy, the light weight of glory. We trade that yoke of vengeance right for the weight of glory. Forgiveness releases the wronged person from this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, retaliation. It just says, God, this is yours. That's how, part of how we can breathe easy and get free. This is yours to do, not mine. Besides, you're the only one who knows how to bring true justice anyway. But you know, it's hard, but as we continue to, and we'll keep, it's a process. We keep giving it back, so that we keep picking it up. We give it back, we give it back. But as we continue to do this over time, what we'll find is the energy that's tied up in our hatred, the energy that's tied up in desiring vengeance, gets freed up for better things. It gets freed up for love. It gets freed up for freedom, for living this abundant life, and for the kingdom. Over time, it also helps us to live into this reality that we're more than victims. That our unforgiveness only hurts ourselves. You know that old saying about unforgiveness is me drinking poison thinking it's going to kill you. No. And then what we, in this process of forgiveness, as we stay with it and all the challenges of it, in time, what begins to happen? That heart opens, the burden's lifted, and we experience the peace that truly passes all understanding that can come when we join Jesus in his process of forgiveness and hopefully reconciliation. Every one of us, at least once, has been terribly wronged in our life. We have each felt the pain of rocks thrown at us by others. But Jesus invites us to three kinds of forgiveness. First, self-forgiveness. See, Jesus asked the woman, "Is there anybody left here to condemn you?" She said, "No one." That included herself. Stop condemning yourself. Forgive yourself. Second, the forgiveness of God. He says, "Oh, well, neither do I condemn you." Jesus, God in human flesh, did not condemn her. He invites her to go, remember who you are, remember who God is, live an honored, honorable life. Forgive yourself. Receive God's forgiveness. And then the third kind of forgiveness is forgiving those who have wronged you. And as I said earlier, that is a process. I would suggest if you're here today and that pain is still fresh and deep, you might do what Jesus did on the cross. Jesus did not directly forgive them himself. "Father, you forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." He could see them, but he was in such pain. In that moment, it is comforting to know that when we're in such pain, we do not have to work up something we're not feeling. We just say, "Father, forgive them." If this is an old wrong, please ask God to help you open the prison door and let that person go free, because what you're going to find out is you're going to experience freedom by setting them free. Easier said than done. A lot more to talk about. It's a process. But start somewhere. Talk to God. Tell God and yourself the truth. And then at another time, we're going to unpack more of the process that God gives us when the wrong must actually be addressed with the person who's wronged you.
I get the sense that maybe there were some of us who needed that this morning, and maybe a longer version of that than we might have otherwise done. Why don't we just skip down to the reflection time,
well,
rather than adding more words.
Honoring is invitational is the next one, which I think we've been saying the word invite all the way through this morning. Just hear the invitation that God is asking of you in your wrongedness, being wronged. And that Jesus honoring is humble, okay? So let's walk humbly with our God even when we're wronged. As we close, you guys okay? You all right? I mean, we really do need to talk about all this in church, though, don't we? We really do. And part of the reason we do this is not only for your sakes, but to equip you. So as you're going out in a world, in a culture, in a presidential election year, especially, that you have some way of, by bringing Jesus with you, some ways in which you can be, Christ's hand and feet and heart, wherever it is you go. As we close, we're going to offer you another reflection. Like we did last week, we offered you a reflection that Tony mentioned on the prodigal. Sorry, I'm still in the forgiveness stuff in my spirit. On the prodigal's sons last week, this week we're going to offer you a similar kind of a reflection on another parable that Jesus told that really brings together a lot of what we've been talking about this morning. And it's the parable of the Good Samaritan. There's the images. It's actually, the one on the left is Delacroix. The one on the right is Van Gogh. 40 years after Delacroix painted this more realistic one, Van Gogh admitted himself to an insane asylum because he was suffering so much. And while he was there, he repainted Delacroix. Same thing, same parable. You know the story well. There's a man beaten on the side of the road. He's been wronged by the robber and wronged by the priest and the scribe and the Levite who just passed him by. They just walk by, see him there, and keep on going. Why? We're not going to touch him. We hate him. We're Jews. But he's, you know, we're going to make ourselves unclean if we touch him. No, nope, we're going to the temple. We're going to go worship God and sing all of our worship songs, wave things, our arms around in the air, but we're not going to use our hands to pick him up. Along comes a good Samaritan, sees this wronged man bleeding on the side of the road. But the Samaritan was also wronged by the Jewish culture and the legalists who said the Samaritans are half-breeds, that they don't follow God. They're like the lepers and the adulterous woman and everyone else who we don't approve of. So the Samaritan was also wronged, and here's this Jewish guy. Wow, he could have just justified it, written in the sand, first time. He just could have walked right by, looked down on him, said, you know what? You're getting what you deserve. This is the consequence of being as hateful a person as you are toward people like me. He could have just kept going, but he doesn't. This Samaritan stops. He cares for him. And he goes way beyond the second mile. He bent down the second time. He uses his hands to pick this man up. Do you see the embrace all the way through? The leper, the woman. And now he picks up this man in his arms. He lifts him onto his horse. He takes and he uses his hands. He gets completely unclean with the blood of this man. He lifts him on the horse and he takes him to an inn where he can be cared for and nursed back to health, to healing. And he pays for everything out of his own pocket. And the question is, who's wronged? Right? Who's wrong? Or as Jesus says it, who is the neighbor? Questions for you to take with you this week. We're going to, as we did last week, ask you that if you want to talk, to go out in the foyer as we close the service, that we would leave some space here. We're going to leave the questions up for you. If you'd like to just sit and reflect, or maybe you want to jot the questions down, go home and maybe Google one of these images so that you can pray, because it's an ongoing process. But the questions that this parable and what we're talking about today ask us are, have I been wronged? If so, by whom? Who else has been wronged in my life or my world? It's not just me that's been wronged. Open your eyes. Who else has been wronged? How does Jesus, how does God honor them? How does God honor me in the midst of this? And how would God have me honor everyone as well? Amen?
We'll post these again in a moment so you can stay with them or jot them down. Let's stand together, and there's a simple closing prayer. Very parallel to the one we prayed at the end of last week's message. Let's pray this together, if we can. God, thank you for honoring me, especially when I am wronged. Give me wisdom, courage, and grace to honor others in my life, even or especially when they are wronged, just like Jesus did. Amen. Go live out that prayer this week. Thank you.